Okay, now the fun begins. So pick up your tomato, and if you don't have any, no. So I'm not going to summarize the various items that the speakers have talked about. I think their talks were, in fact, their best summaries. I do want to open this up to discussion, but I heard a couple of different things that, and I'm not necessarily trying to highlight these as more important, but I'm not sure if I've heard them before. And so I just want to emphasize that to me something like this was new. What we haven't talked about really here, except obliquely insofar as we have a methodology, was the notion of governance that Denise raised. You may say that it falls under methodology, and it probably does in some extended sense, but and whether we can quantify that, whether that's a separate dimension, is, again, obviously arguable. But I haven't heard that, even though we understand that, in some sense, we all need to worry about configuration, management, versioning, et cetera, for any product that we have as a software engineering product. In our discussions, dimensions and distinctions discussions, we tried kind of subjectively to make these orthogonal, but recognizing that in fact they are not really orthogonal. I think it's useful to try to achieve some orthogonality, but I'm not sure that we have. And when you look at the dimensions and distinctions that we've offered up to this point, they kind of, at some point, maybe bleed together. I mean, for example, degree of structure, you might say that there's some connection between that and the language you use to express the content. In other words, if you only have one kind or two kind of things, let's say, propositional logic, where you only have propositions and things that put those propositions together, the structure is going to be pretty minimal that your content can achieve. So there is some connection. Now, again, English, natural language, you have, it's informal. What is the characterization of that structure, right? It's if our language is enabled us to express infinite number of sentences, we can gauge that complexity and, the structure that must be inherent in that. But as opposed to, a logic, well, then it gets a little bit more, arguable. We had other folks that, for example, Paula, that tried to elaborate more along the lines of the design methodology, and Mike Gruninger pointed it out that right now we have maybe kind of a polarity there, but really there's truly a spectrum. And in fact, one thing I just want to emphasize here without taking up any other time is that we wanted a scale originally, at least some of us, for any of these dimensions, but the more we discussed this, the more we thought that it's difficult. It's not a Boolean. It's not, zero and one, and maybe it's not even a linear scale, so it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We kind of gave up that. I mean, I think it's a topic here as to whether we want to address that. The potential range of values, even when we decide what these dimensional aspects are, is a point of discussion. So, anyways, I want to open everything up that we've talked about up to this point to general discussion.
Leo, Todd Schneider, Raytheon. Two questions, and you'll have to excuse my ignorance. I didn't do my homework properly here. But from what I read last night about the framework and the dimensions listed and what I heard today, two aspects I did not hear addressed completely in any of the dimensions, and if they are, please tell me, where does natural language issues come in, terminological issues? And the other had to do with philosophical assumptions, and if you like, you could put it in the context of upper ontologies. Is there a dimension to delineate the philosophical assumptions you're making and how you're going to construct your ontology?
Could you announce yourself also?
I do, Peter. Todd Schneider, Raytheon.
I don't know if you can display our initial briefing, Mike Gruninger's and mine. There are some issues. Wait till it's displayed again. And page down more. Continue. Okay, continue. Degree of formality and structure we'll talk about, but even within this one, so in terms of formality, right, so that where the bullet says that more formal taxonomy can be term or concept-based, again, we're trying to eke out, if you will, term, concept, something maybe real-world referent. It's incomplete here, but you can imagine that term-based is focusing more on the natural language side, if you will. If you want to forward again, I'm just trying to, I think those are important points, and I just want to point out that there's probably aspects of this, of your comments through here. For example, the first bullet, dimension partially dependent on the first, if it's expressed in English, again, that's another issue. And whether, English can be loose and it can be precise. The next one, if you want to page down, representational granularity, again, underscores that, this could be in English or in a formal language, but now we're focusing on essentially the average depth or average breadth and depth of the description, and maybe notions of precision coming into play here. And then the next one, intended use application. Well, not so much. I would go to the next one, pragmatic dimension, and another slide forward. More the descriptive versus prescriptive. Again, I think your philosophical predisposition comes into play here, and it may not fit exactly well. So the range we know of between, realist, strong realist position, that Werner tried to present earlier, versus something that's not quite so strong, more of a, conceptualist. And there's other areas in this realm. So we have some of what you mentioned, but we don't have a lot, and it's probably spread across a couple of the dimensions.
Todd Schneider again. One reason I asked that question, because if we want to come up with an engineering methodology, it would be very helpful in terms of selling it to people who have money to distinguish what we are doing and how it makes or how it could be compared to what other people are doing, getting back to the comparison capability or lack thereof.
I think you were next.
Could I just take a quick stab at responding to that? I think those are two really good points, and I've noted them to try to work them into the framework. I think your whether something is natural language or not pertains to what I would call the entities, because if it's a word, basically you're looking at a word, phrase, sentence, etc., and all the morphological rules of the language in which it is expressed, okay, which to me relates to the entities, and that's just a facet of that. But your philosophical assumptions, to me, fits into the context, because then we have a sense of where it's coming from. So thank you for the question.
Okay, right here, and then Tom.
Yeah, Peter Brown. In no particular order. Okay, thanks. Just a few sort of random concerns and questions about all the presentations so far this morning. One of them relates both to Michael's opening remarks, which I think Denise possibly answered partly with the model she's proposing, is I'm worried about sort of danger of prefiguring intended scope of any ontology, because you may think you've got an ontology which is useful for your domain, but you find suddenly it's being used by other people for a different purpose and for a different scope, and you can never prefigure that. And I think that's something we need to address. In that context, one sort of catchphrase, sort of elevated pitch we've been using a lot in Europe recently is we must talk more about, or less about, interoperability of standards and more about standards of interoperability. By which we mean, it's not just enough to have standards and have definitions, you've got to have some sort of bridging and mapping mechanism between them. And I think the attempts to build a framework which identifies different axes, whether it's the 7 in the original statement or the 4 that Denise proposes, find some way that you can make some sort of assessment or judgment about different ontologies, and from that make some certain conclusions about the possible use, even if it's beyond the intended scope of use. I think Werner's point about ontologies being based exclusively on universals rather than particulars, I would say that's probably for me an important distinction between ontologies and taxonomies, and I think that's for me a simple layperson's takeaway which will help me sort of re-engineer some of our efforts on that. But we've talked about ontology being a word, but I mean all words are a bridge to understanding in that sense. I would argue very much for a very informal lay definition of the word ontology we're using in our work here. And as an example of that, if I can quickly find it, there was in the original statement we talked about ontology being, now, you want to help me, sorry here. I can't remember. There was something about saying ontology is a, what is it, the specification. Yeah, I mean, I would just dump those 6 words because it's the phrase following it which is important, which actually explains by which we mean da 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 da. I mean, someone like me is probably unlikely to read onto that second phrase if you're already stumped with this first phrase. So I think that's about, that's my input for now.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, I think it's been really great that several people have pointed out that one way of succeeding in this community is to establish an engineering discipline around this. And, I come from a computer science background as well as philosophy, it turns out. But more, I consider the engineering problems way more interesting and hard because we have to change the behavior of millions of people with this. And so how does that work? Well, I mean, a long time ago we proposed the beginnings of a methodology for this. But the very core fundamental pieces of an engineering discipline is you start from the point of view, the approach that says you have requirements. In this case, it could be use cases, intended use, functional requirements, but you have some kind of requirements. You have some kind of decision-making process, and you have some kind of evaluation process against requirements. You can take formal evaluation or functional evaluation, operational evaluation. There's a lot of ways to evaluate, but you have to start from something like that. If you buy that, because that's just basically what all of engineering does, including software engineering. Now, software engineering has struggled with that because we end up having a lot of folks that can, do it all themselves and don't have to ever say why they're doing it. We have that bit, And also, a lot of times people build just bottom up. So here's a part, let's glue them together. Now, the other piece of engineering discipline has to do more like this standards part, the S in NIST, I guess, which is the point of software standards and so on is interoperability or reuse. And there are properties of ontologies that can make them more or less reusable. Now, one property is the hard one, which is like, how do you guess the intended use? Okay? And that's where some folks who are trying to build like these upper ontologies are attempting to do something that has either no use or all uses, depending on how you look at it. In other words, it's not deliberately trying to constrain itself by a use. On the other hand, if you imagine, not as opposed to that, but an augmentation to that, lots and lots of ontologies that were designed for a use, but were designed with a methodology that leads to generality, right? And the aesthetics for a software that's designed that way is well understood in software engineering. It's minimality, okay, and consistency. So you reduce the interfaces as much as you can, and you make sure that they're all consistent with each other and well documented. So we can have those properties for engineering of ontologies. And I think that maybe one of the take-homes we might be able to offer the world is this is an engineering discipline, and that things we're creating are engineered artifacts that have much of the same function, that are reusable. Like they're not equal to software, but they have a very strong analogy with software. That's my piece.
We have Paula on the phone that has a comment.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks. I have two questions. Sorry, there is some echo in my hand. Can you hear echo?
Yes, we hear an echo.
Oh, sorry. Let me just switch off the microphone on Skype, maybe.
And speak up, too, Paula.
Question for Werner. First, you seem to define on slide 2 a kind of black and white approach. You seem to say either particular or universals, either occurrence or continuance, dependent or independent. And my question is, do you see anything in between? I wanted to say first that I really like the presentation. I like the idea that you're introducing the perspective issue of reality, capturing reality as opposed to a subjective view of reality, which is the Kiriko's one. But my question is, do you really see the word as either or? And how do you deal with all the in-betweens, which is probably the world it's most made of? Is my question clear?
Yes. Can you hear me? I just unmuted the line.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, the three categories that I present, for these three, there is a lot of echo.
Yeah, I can hear the echo.
Okay. Oh, that's better. For the three categories or the three distinctions that I presented, there is indeed nothing in between. And that has to do what the things themselves are. What are particulars? What are universals? What is dependent? What is independent? But when we design an ontology or when we look at the world, then we look at the entities in reality and we ascribe them to the different categories. So dependent and independence can be at the same time go with being particular or universal, and in some cases for occurrences and continuance. So all occurrences, for instance, they are dependent. They depend on the continuance that participate in them. For continuance themselves, yeah, there are continuance, such as my shape. There are independent continuance, such as me. And those three categories that I described are just the three upper levels. So there are much more at the granular level categories according to which you can categorize particulars and universals. What you must understand, however, is that what I presented there is the approach that we are taking here in Buffalo. So, of course, I would like to see that approach to be used by everybody who claims to develop ontologies, and I'm afraid that's unattainable. This approach to ontology that I presented is not mainstream. Okay, so the mainstream thing in ontology is being concept-based.
Right. Why
are we sticking to that kind of approach? That is, we assessed the quality of several concept-based ontologies according to the principle of realism. And by doing so, we have been able to identify quite a lot of inconsistencies. And to that effect, we are not alone. If you look at Nicola Guarino's OntoClean method, in which he was also be able to identify mistakes in primarily in hierarchical structures, that also took a philosophical realism approach. And that is the reason why I so strongly believe in those things.
Yeah, I'd like to... Renner, let me add to the question here because I have a specific issue. This is Pat Cassidy. When I was working trying to integrate the BFO with Psych and Sumo, for example, one of the issues that came up was what you categorize as dependent and independent. And one of the dependents in the BFO is a role, and, of course, independence would be, say, people. And yet I want to categorize a student, and I find it convenient to have multiple inheritance, which is forbidden in the BFO, and have a student be both a role and a person. And this is convenient because I'd like to stick as close as possible to linguistic expressions. And when somebody says the student threw the ball, I don't want to have to say the person who is in the role of the student threw the ball. I'd like the linguistic expression to be meaningful even within the parameters of the ontology. Now, as Pat Hayes has mentioned, you can have both of these things and you can have translations between them. Of course, I can say that the student is a role and a person, and if you want to translate into the BFO, I can differentiate those and make a separate expression saying, the person who is in the role of the student did this, that, or the other thing. So we can translate between these. But my point is that when you're talking about methodologies, that when you if you insist that one approach be used and not attempt to find translations between one approach and the other, that we will unnecessarily fail to take advantage of each other's work.
I can answer that very specifically. When you are putting what you are proposing with the student and the person also, if you want to do it in the way that you express it, then you are confusing two different things. In our ontology, we would never put them together. We would recognize the different things, and although we would not use multiple inheritance at that level, there is no problem for any particular to be annotated with universals coming from different hierarchies. Okay, so the only thing that you need to do is to use the appropriate relationship for that. The solution, as you indicated, is indeed translation. So translations can help you to do that. Now, unfortunately, if you stick to your approach, it will be possible for our ontologies, so which are built in spirit of realism, to translate them correctly into your type of ontology, but the other way around would not work. So that's a problem of your ontology. It's not a problem of our ontology. Do you see what I mean?
If you say so.
Mike. I just want to interject here. We don't want to necessarily be comparing the specific ontologies and their issues. I think what we want to do is take a step back. We want to extract out, you know, again, are there some things that have been said that people have fairly strong disagreements? I know people have pretty strong disagreements because it's generated over 370 email messages in 72 hours. But, you know, if we're here now in person and face-to-face, and so if we can air those disagreements and resolve them and extract something constructive out here, and also to then also to kind of recognize, again, what these differences are. So the comment about... you know, the philosophical stance, right? That we can say, well, yes, you know, every ontology may take implicitly a philosophical stance, recognize that as a dimension, not requiring an ontology to have a particular philosophical stance, right? And then that's something we can extract. I mean, it's like anything in science too; it takes a philosophical stance, but you don't have to subscribe to one or the other to be considered a scientific theory. So, if we can maybe try to corral the discussion in that direction.
Steve, you?
I just wanted to also keep us grounded. I think that while I completely agree with what Tom had said about, you know, the desirability of an engineering discipline for ontologies, I think that's going to be far too ambitious, obviously, for us to tackle here. I mean, really, we're all about a very modest goal here of trying to come up with this framework. once we have that, we can start talking about how could you use the framework to help define or lay a foundation for an engineering discipline. But I think if we keep ourselves focused on the modest goal, we can get there in the next 2 days.
Ken?
Yeah, I'd like to get back actually to some remarks that Tom made. In looking over the dimensions, there are two dimensions that really apply to any engineering artifact, and indeed there will be other dimensions that also apply to any engineering artifact. I think it would be really helpful if we focused on those dimensions that are essentially unique or at least special to ontologies. Because we're not going to get very far if we're going to be busy trying to reinvent all of the terminology and dimensions associated with general artifacts. So I think there are actually five. It comes down to just five dimensions. If we say these five plus, as an artifact, we have intended use and we have design methodology and governance and all these other aspects that are not unique to this particular kind of artifact. So I think it would be really helpful if we focused on just those. Okay.
Arturo Sanchez, University of North Florida. I completely agree with what Ray just said and Michael, and trying to stick to that. From all the discussions that I've heard so far, I don't see any glaring example that cannot be expressed by the dimensions that the framework is expressing. The things that I've seen so far are the philosophical stance, which could be arguably subsumed by things such as intended use and the design methodology. There's an interesting concept also about governance that Ms. Bedford brought up. And I would also argue that could be embedded in the framework. So I guess that one exercise before trying to go forward is whether or not the ontologies that I know, the ontologies that I have developed, that I have used, can be characterized in terms of the proposed framework. If the answer is no, then say or propose what is the dimension that you see in your ontology that is not captured by the framework. I have a couple of points in this direction. One is syntax. I do understand that when you talk about semantics, the syntax kind of come with it because you have to use some language to express your semantics. But from a pragmatic perspective, the syntax that you use might end up affecting the whole impact of the ontology. And the second one is that if you go to once you have, we are now in the business of defining the thing, right, the old thing, but there is a level above that, which is once you define what those things are, what do you do with them? So if you have an O1 thing and an O2 thing, how can you put the two of them together? That's another level that I don't know if the framework would capture, or if it was the intention to capture that.
Just to intervene here, there's a couple other folks lined up, but one issue that we haven't put out there yet, but maybe gets to your last point in particular, is your ontology or your artifact linked to an upper ontology, a foundational ontology, a middle ontology, a super domain, whatever you want to call it, because it may become important when we down the road 5 years, and we have these dimensions fairly well explored, whether that's the case or not. But how do you, again, you know, the meta issue? How do you put these things together? We know some of the coordinate space, and we hope that'll help. But then there may be additional things. Let's see. I'm not sure who is next here.
We got one.
Let's do the online there, Tom, and then Peter. Somebody online had a point on the phone?
Paula, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here. When is it my turn?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
That was the second question to Werner, which somehow I think made the point, was trying to lead towards the underlying assumption, which has been raised as one of the things that we should try to discuss, I hope, because there is a lot going on there. My second question to Werner was, and I'm taking Werner's example because I think it's a good one, of some discussions, important discussions which are going on. Werner's example of reality representation is important and relevant to a lot of what we are doing or we are trying to do in defining this framework, I think. This is why I'm talking about it. Werner, at some stage, says that realism, I want to question the realistic view and recall some of the discussion about the philosophical standpoint. Werner, you seem to claim that reality is something that you can objectively define. And I agree to some extent. But I also think there are some subjective dimensions of reality that you cannot forget when you're trying to say, I am depicting reality and not a concept that represents reality. I understand you, and I think it's okay. But we have to be careful because I give you the example of the Chinese medicine. If you look at the chart of a doctor, a medical doctor, a Western allopathic doctor, what they figure out in the body are muscles, bones, tendons, whatever, the heart. If you look at the chart, the medical chart of a Chinese doctor or another type of doctor, which I don't know in what account you hold this type of medicine, possibly some people say it's not scientific, but you're not going to go into that argument. They depict other things that we cannot see, like the lines, the meridians. And in some other types of medicine, like Ayurvedic medicine, they actually figure out other parts, like centers, some other energies, I don't know what the doshas, whatever. So every system of medicine looks at different representation of the reality of the body. And that is a good example for me to show that what you call reality, to some extent, is a subjective statement or a subjective choice. According to what you believe in, according to your philosophical standpoint. So while I really enjoy the fact that you're bringing this out in your presentation, I would say realism has got a long way to go before it can say it's comprehensively depicting reality, because reality extends well beyond what each of us can consider real.
Charles,
what I explained in my presentations were the principles of realism. I did not go into describing specific systems. So if Western medicine is described according to the realism principles and Chinese medicine are done in the same way, then what you are describing is not a matter of subjectivity, but is a matter on what way to be used to discover what is objective in reality. And of course, on the basis of differences in culture and whatever aspect, we might see the things in a different way. What is not the case is that there would be two different realities. So it would be wrong to say there is one reality, which is the one which we see in Europe, and there is the one which Chinese doctors see. No, there is only one reality, but they describe it in a different way. And
I'm not fine. Yeah, thank you, Werner. I really think this is an interesting discussion, and I want to go on with this, but not maybe necessarily now here. I wanted to raise the point that realism, this view is an important one because depicting reality is key to our ontology exercise, but is maybe not that straightforward, I don't think. But it's something that we can talk about.
Okay, thank you. Charles has a comment.
This is Chuck Knudsen from Old Dominion University. As an introducer of at least two of the dimensions during the original email conversation, I had a couple of points to make, and the second one may come back to this conversation, this ongoing conversation we're having about reality. The first, descriptive versus prescriptive. Initially, when I introduced that, what I had in mind, a descriptive ontology would be one describing systems that already exist. When a system is designed or built, of course, the designer has some sort of ontology in their mind, and it's implicitly there. This may be in a case, I work a lot with modeling simulation, a traffic model where cars may only drive on the road. Of course, in the model, that's reality for the universe described by that model. If you're doing a prescriptive model of traffic or for traffic models, of course, you would want to allow that cars could drive off of roads. So you could have emergency vehicles or, in the state of Virginia where I'm from, people like to park on their lawn. So descriptive and prescriptive may get to the heart of the difference between maybe a low-level or application ontology versus an upper-level or intentional versus extensional type definitions. Okay, so that's point one. Point two, on the granularity of representation, what I initially had in mind there, some of the conversations that have gone on in the past couple of months with Matthew West and some of the other people looking at a 4D representation of reality, 3D representation of reality. If we look at anything that has a process and the results of a process, whether it's physics, human behavior, whatever, we can look at it in a number of different ways. You can look at the prime movers, such as vehicles, or we can look at the physics behind it and so on. So your focus of your representation, granularity representation, becomes very important. And this comes back to the reality conversation we just had. Can something be a continuant and an occurrent at the same time? I think modern physics proves yes. If we look at something, anything deep enough, any continuant, it actually becomes a series of occurrence with some perceived persistence. So that granularity representation is important to get, and this may also tie to the philosophy behind your ontology. So.
I think we have Tom, then we have Peter, then we have Peter Brown, and then whoever else.
Great. Thanks, Tom Gruber again. So I think we're doing a thinko here. Because if you look at the first talk, Peter saying, this is what we're trying to do, come up with a way of communicating to the world with an ontology, what kind of things are ontologies and so on. And then this session is about frameworks and the dimension of the frameworks, I said dimensions. And then we're saying, well, let's stick to the dimensions, but let's make sure we talk about the interesting ones, okay? Actually, I think the problem is it's not like that getting a bunch of dimensions is going to tell us what it is. I mean, look at Denise's pictures. It's not the axes that tell you what it is. It's the shapes of the things in the axes and the units that are on the axes. So if we talk about what's an ontology to a colleague, the best way I do it is just say, here's some of the things you can do with one. That's intended use. So populating the exact units on that axis is really important. If you want to know, like, what is it? Why is level of structure an interesting thing for ontologies and not for other things? Or how is it like other things? I mean, yes, it turns out you can do software morphology analysis and figure out how much of that's in there. But really, there's some very interesting reasons why things differ by structure in the ontology world. So let's talk about those ways that they structure. And even things like the expressivity of the language. Now, in a computing world, everything's Turing complete, so it doesn't matter. They're all equally expressive, right? But there's some reason why databases have a limited expressibility and ontologies have more. There's a good reason. There's a bunch of good reasons, and that's a real defining characteristic for ontologies. And so that, I think, is the way we can now turn it on its head and say, which are the values of the dimensions can help us understand what the ontology beast is? And then and then in the afternoon, when we place everybody on there, we'll get to see what are the shapes of the various ontology spaces.
Okay. Peter?
Yes. First of all, I think this is great discussion. And as a lot of you have already mentioned, the philosophical discussions will not get resolved here. We welcome it to continue on the Ontolog Forum for the next 3,000 years, if we're around long enough. But actually, my next question is for Tom. Do we actually already have enough to go by for the afternoon session so that we can actually pick a few artifacts, FOV or Dublin Core or Sumo, and plot them in, and do we actually have the dimensions and the measures? I think we've addressed dimensions fairly well, but did we have the measures. For example, in Denise's slides, I mean, I sort of see four lines. I mean, is it a scale of 1 to 4, or I mean, do we rank things 1 to 5? Do we rank things yes or no? Obviously, different dimensions ask for these things. So maybe we could spend a little bit of time addressing some of the major dimensions and put the measures in there so that Tom could have maybe a more concrete framework to go by.
In fact, that would just do it the way around. I think we probably yacked enough about the dimensions in an abstract sense. Why don't we just get on with some examples and place them, and then that'll tell us like what units of measure we need on each axis. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, just don't start with one, start with two, and then just compare more or less, and then you work out the units more discreetly down the road. And mm-hmm. As long as I've got the mic, can I add something? Yes.
Can you wait a second, Sue, so we maintain strict order? No. Pete around, and then Susan.
It's going to be a gallant gentleman and pass the mic straight over to Susan. But, no, I mean, actually, Peter Yin covered 95% of what I was going to say. And I think it's probably we're in the same sort of wavelength here. I mean, my concern is we seem to have a consensus around the fact that there are dimensions. I think it's already a step forward. The question is now, do we accept, I think Denise is the only one who's actually put that very explicitly in her slides, that the dimensions must be orthogonal. And I think that for me is a starting point in terms of methodology of how we go forward. And I think your idea of take two, check them out, whether they're orthogonal. If they're orthogonal, start trying to find what sort of scale you're using, whether it's purely binary or some sort of sliding scale or whatever, and then move on to a third one. I think my point is just that, methodological rather than content.
Okay, Susan.
Yeah, and actually the thought I had was triggered by Ken's remarks. It was interesting that on the issues, education was so high, and you described it as we need to, better communicate what we're about and the values, but then it was low on the solution side, and I got to thinking kind of where I sit when I think of the end game, end goal. I would love to see the contributions of your community to support the interdisciplinary collaboration. So a metric would be the quality of the conversation among diverse disciplines that have been pulled together for some emergency, and somehow what you've done makes it possible for them to have, less of this loaded terms and the, sliding plate tectonics, where they basically can understand each other's worlds because of the framing that the different approaches bring. And each of the disciplines, of course, if you were to look at how they see the world, you could, I think, map their the strengths of their disciplines in the formality or informality. So I really see that. I mean, if next door to us was a room of diverse disciplines, name them, and they have a purpose and they really can't talk to each other and they're not having fun, if your contribution could be an approach that helps them see those ahas faster and work better together.
Over here and then here.
This is Herb Bassett from Lockheed Martin. I think we're a long way from getting a set of valid dimensions. I think most of what we've been talking about today is still preaching to the choir. We're talking about it in terms of the technical community of ontologists. So I'd like to follow up on what Denise said, is that we really need to have two sets of dimensions. One set of dimensions that's inward facing, that we're all talking about here, and another set of dimensions that's outward facing, that the users or the buyers or the executives or the business community would see the value of what we're trying to do. So one of the ones that Denise mentioned, which I thought would be an outward-facing dimension that would really be valid, is the governance. How can someone outside this community know what they're buying or know the value of what they're buying if we don't have a governance dimension? So my suggestion would be that we have a set of technical dimensions that are inward-facing for us, a set of outward dimensions that are community focused for the broader world.
Okay, over
here. Question
on
that, if I could. Would you suggest that your outward dimensions be an abstraction of the inward dimensions, or would they be different?
No, they'd be different. I think they'd be a totally different set of concepts, a totally different perspective of trying to deal with an executive versus trying to deal with a computer scientist. So I think they'd really be fundamentally distinct dimensions.
Okay, over here, then I'm going to interject Ken, and then Denise, and then Frank.
I just want to offer the metaphor of using the word views, probably, and then each view has its own set of dimensions. I just wanted also to mention that once we are past deciding what these dimensions are, I just want to offer an example that you can find from communications of the ACM, just Association for Computer Machinery, when it comes to characterizing different disciplines within computing. They have come up with this kind of KVR graphs, similar to the ones Ms. Bedford showed. I'm very skeptical, though, when it comes to coming up with specific metrics other than, you know, less and more. So this will just give us a visual representation of a class of ontologies. And then based on those shapes, we can talk about it. But this is just another view of the whole spectrum.
Okay, Ken.
Okay. When I talked about distinguishing between those dimensions that are common to all artifacts, I didn't suggest we don't consider them. In fact, they're very important, and those are, to a large extent, the outwardly facing ones, and we certainly want to try to characterize ontologies from those points of view in addition to the others. The other thing I wanted to say was that as I was developing my slides for the afternoon session, based on the survey responses, I hit exactly this point. I had lists of ontologies or lists of concepts or terms that are equivalent to ontology, and I couldn't see what to fill in. I knew in most cases what those ontologies were, but I didn't know what words to place into the various slots. Should I put low high? Should I put no, yes? What do I say? So it's one thing to know an ontology. It's another to know this framework. And I think we really need to work on having a fairly simple framework so that one can very quickly, you know, characterize, at least on a certain coarse granularity, each of the ontologies. And as I say, in the afternoon session, I have a list of 70 ontology artifacts that are basically something for us to work on, so that we can see if they will actually be amenable to this framework.
Denise.
Just two quick points. I really like the idea of the internal and the external. The only challenge I have with that is who's internal? Because does that mean it's a linguist? Does that mean it's an engineer? Does that mean it's a computer scientist? I think we have to, you know, who are us? Who are we? And I think we are a diverse group amongst ourselves, so we're going to have to work through that. The other thing is, I think that the factor approach will work. If we can take a country and model its knowledge economy, which is a very, very complex issue, I think we can use it to model ontologies. The challenge we have is identifying the factors that make up each of those dimensions and that basically are... And nothing is ever perfect. You don't have a perfect solution. But if you can come up with a solution that at least allows you to communicate to the developer or a potential user, then you've achieved your goal.
Frank.
I think the issue of governance is an important one, and it's related to... the question of whether or not these ontologies include some provision for provenance. And so, as Bill McCarthy here would remind us, and folks from EPA, any ontology which is describing anything of legal significance, for example, you will generally find that the communities involved, be they the accounting profession or the environmental legal community or the IRS or whatever, are not about to entrust these things to computer scientists or linguists sitting around a room. That we have legislators, we have judges, we have lawyers. They have written tomes on what is the meaning of wetlands. I know EPA at one point had 7 different definitions for what a wetland was depending on the controlling legislation. And so this gets at the issue of context. So I think that if we are going to build ontologies that are of practical significance for helping to write software about income taxes or other sorts of things like this, we're going to have to recognize that we don't have autonomous control over these definitions. We may be allowed to formalize them, derived from natural language definitions, but usually the controlling definitions are incorporated in some piece of legislation, some piece of federal regulation, an accounting standard, an engineering standard, or something like this. And I think it's important that we recognize these things as major sources for ontological knowledge. I think that we need to think systematically about transferring them from natural language into some more formal representation. And I think we need provenance mechanisms to record how we did this and what the controlling authority is. People in the library community have long had authority lists and things like this, particularly for proper nouns and things like this. But I think the ontology community has typically not paid much attention to this, because we've seen ourselves as autonomous designers of these things, and I think that we would have a much easier time of selling these constructions to many of the potential users or financiers of this if we could explain that, oh, we took, you know, X piece of legislation or X accounting standard, and we captured it in formal logic or something like this, and here are all the citations, and if you change this, we have a mechanism for telling you what you need to change in the ontology. I think this would greatly improve the acceptability of these things across broad communities.
Frank, I'd like to follow up. I agree with you totally on provenance and its importance, and I think that will help with what Susan's desire is. I'm Dr. Catherine Goodyear. I'm with NCI. And several of you have worked with me on ontologies before in communities that we can't share in this environment because we're governed in this environment by a set of sharing rules. But to keep this from happening, Susan, we're going to have a methodology by which this sharing community can participate with the non-sharing community. And that provenance, that labeling that we use on our terms to define what's appropriate to share, what's appropriate not to share, has as much importance in the sharing community as it does in the secret world. So if we want to be able to really open these doors and keep this gap from happening, we're going to have to understand how we appropriately label that provenance on our vocabularies.
Leo, can I respond?
We have another person here, then you can go next after that.
I won't take very long. My name is Mark Bolgiano. I work for a standards organization. I feel like I'm crashing the ontologist party a little bit here. But I had to – actually, I'm being made to feel very welcome, which I appreciate. But I had to pipe up after what Frank had to say, because we're an XML – XBRL is an extension of XML. And right now we're engaged in a $6 million project for the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission to represent GAAP, an accounting standard, in a taxonomy form. And for those of you, I'm sure most of you read this, but if you haven't, for those of you who haven't heard of the book by Lawrence Lessig, a professor at Stanford, Code 2.0, and his discussion of West Coast code versus East Coast code. Code is law, and as code is what runs on our machines. I think you'll find a very relevant discussion there that we're right in the midst of, dealing with FASB and the people who write the accounting standards canon that has nothing to do with technology, and XBRL that's going to be used for all the SEC 10K, 10Q filings, and where all the buzzwords are things like intangibles and governance and some very squishy concepts, and in fact concepts being our main vocabulary word, just to make it interesting. But the thread that I hear running through here is about bringing ontologies down to the ground is exactly why I'm here. I'd have to be honest. I don't know if this is recorded, but I think most of my members and most of the people in the XBRL community make absolutely no connection to ontologies. Taxonomies is what we're all about, but not to ontologies. And yet one of our big holy grails, you know, is not only interoperability, but comparability.
This is Todd Schneider. I want to respond to the comments that were made by Frank, I believe, talking about provenance and the process. Well, you'll appreciate this, Susan. There's already a process for doing or meeting many of those requirements that you specified. It's called enterprise architecture. Now, if you follow that, you will get most of what you need right there. Now, the issue about interoperability, there's two points there. The secret, well, you're never going to get over that. But for the federal government that isn't bound by those constraints, Susan, I would suspect the FEA should address that in a very coherent fashion, where then you can get interoperability. OMB says, well, if this is part of the enterprise architecture, that you must have an ontology to some degree, blah, 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 whatever upper part you want to use or not use, then, you know, if you want to get your funding, you have to be able to be federated in some fashion with other ontologies. So the federal government has a solution to that problem for the interoperability, for the whole building process. The enterprise architecture paradigm provides a lot of help there.
Tom?
And Tom Gruber. And two points on that. One is really, it's fantastic we're onto this. I just came back from a conference in Edinburgh about geosemantics ontologies. And at that conference, there was people talking. These folks have their act together for ontologies. They have a massive data integration problem. And provenance is a legal requirement for them. So they have actually gotten their heads around this. Ontology is a technology to help them with the provenance problem. Okay? Not only does it map, like, so say there's some map data. The olden ways of doing map data was they just draw some colors on a square, on a rectangle. And then that's the data set, basically. And then as it got computerized, the computer guys just inherited that old model. And it's really like 40 or 50, 100 features deep. And the boundaries are not, they're just some polygons, and sometimes they're fuzzy polygons and all kinds of other interesting stuff. So one of the things that they do is they explicitly represent the social and political and legal context that design decisions come from. So this is and then there's actually some research where the guys reason about it. So, for instance, if you want to dispatch a query across a heterogeneous data set, then you can say, well, you know, this one makes these assumptions, that one makes those assumptions, so the current query, you know, needs those assumptions, and it can therefore go over there. Now, that's the state of the art, and that's the kind of stuff that we can say to the world, say, this is why ontology is, you have to have it, why it's really important, and not just yet another database schema. And in interoperability among them, there's no other way they could do it. Because you cannot just, there's just apples and oranges. You have to have a translation that has reasoning in it to get from one data set to the next.
Denise, and then.
And thank you for raising that question. One of the hats I wear at the World Bank is I'm responsible for developing what's called a business architecture. So ontologies are critical. The reason I have to develop a business architecture for the World Bank is essentially, oh, we're not being recorded, are we? Oops. Sorry. For that unknown institution that I didn't mention, is because we have to deal with something called Sarbanes-Oxley. Okay? And we have to look at disclosure. We have to prevent things that shouldn't be disclosed from being disclosed. But at the same time, I have to have a business architecture that captures all the records that we're legally required to capture. And I can't do that without an ontology, without many ontologies at this point. I'm probably working with about 20 to 25 ontologies to do that, hopefully in the enterprise architecture context.
Beverly Jamison, American Psychological Association. And I wanted to get back to the issue of how to make things interoperable in a world where shareable and non-shareable information need to coexist. The American Psychological Association, we have some overlap with National Library of Medicine in dealing with the publishing world. And in that, we have rights management, you know, not in quite the same context that you do, but there's a lot of work going on over how do you get the maximum connectivity and interoperability amidst a world where some of your information may not be able to surface or only a portion of it can, et cetera.
Yeah, Peter Brown again. Just two additional comments from the discussion. The question about these two sets of dimensions, also I like that. I'm not sure I share Denise's reservation, but I mean, she might actually agree with me on this in the sense that whether you think it's an internal, one of the internal dimensions or not, is not really a problem. I mean, you may think of yourself as a business user, and in fact what you're actually doing is divining your enterprise ontology. So I think that's down to point of view, but I think it's very useful, this idea of making that distinction when we're doing the reflections. The second thing about the metrics thing is a bit more problematic. I mean, you mentioned the World Bank. If the World Bank can measure knowledge economies, well, it's because it's the World Bank and you've got some authority to do it, and you can kick back sides and withdraw funding if people don't share your points of view. I mean, what I'm trying to say is you've got a very clear set of metrics which you own in terms of making those decisions, whether it's your stakeholders that are helping you share that. I'm not saying the World Bank Secretariat imposes it, but you are making a judgment. And when the point about even saying, is it less than or more than, someone's going to make a judgment call somewhere. And the problem we've got is we are a folksonomy of ontologists, and there is no center, there is no authority. So I think we have to address that problem before we can make any judgment call about less or more. But it's a problem we have to address.
I have to respond to this because there are some inaccuracies there that I just don't want on the record. Okay. The World Bank arrives at these things through consensus. If you are reading the newspaper for the last 2 weeks, you understand our governance processes are very fluid and very very much like a folksonomy, and we are very much a democratically governed institution. Okay, so how we came to identifying the factors, though, that define the dimensions of a knowledge economy was a very democratic process, extreme consultation, et cetera, through all the experts in that domain, just as we have experts in the ontology domain here. I don't see any difference in the process at all.
Except a different community may have a different set of metrics which are not yours. That's all I'm saying. I agree.
Okay.
I'm not questioning the authority or the lack of democracy there. It is a point of view.
That's okay.
Yeah.
We're going to have a point of view too. And I think the biggest challenge for us is to, one, identify the factors and then try to quantify them. I mean, that's an iterative process. I don't see that as something that's going to happen this afternoon or tomorrow morning. I think that's going to be where we may start to think about that process if we decide to go in that direction.
Okay, over here.
Jack Teller from NCI. I would just like to add, because I see now that someone is keeping track, another attribute to our dimensions, in order for them to be fully ripe, they should at least have a quality called invariance. And I don't know how to express that in terms of the many different manifestations of our ontologies, but I'll leave it to say that if, for example, I was measuring granularity in an ontology in one language and tried to look at it after it had been transformed into another language, I should come up with the same value for that measurement. Thank you.
We have a couple more minutes. Bill?
I'm not sure who's keeping track. McCarthy from Michigan State. I just want to echo Frank's point about the connection. Obviously, we're on the same page on this, of connecting to the user communities of whether they be standards groups or the refereed literature in the field or something else like that. I think as ontologists, we're sort of, in some cases, very want to go off and start describing a field from our own personal experiences in reading them instead of consulting the experts for exact definitions of what the concepts are. So Frank brought that up. I don't see it evidenced in the discussion bullets at the front, so I wanted to make sure that if it was a minimum of two people bringing it up, that it makes it onto the bullet page. So.
Frank?
And there's a corollary to this, which is that, how should I say this? The communities of practice that are defining accounting standards and legislation and federal regulatory stuff, how do I say this? They vary as to their philosophical sophistication, but so far as I know, there is no requirement, for example, for congressmen to have a degree in philosophy in order to pass legislation. And the result of that plus political conflict means that you get often not entirely consistent, quote, ontologies. I mean, there are famous examples by which SUVs get turned from automobiles into trucks to deal with tariff issues and things like this. And I think that we are going to need to confront this, I think, probably with a context mechanism. And ultimately, we may have to come face-to-face with the fact that some of these ontologies are going to be inconsistent, and I don't think the technology is well-developed for dealing with that. And it's certainly not something that we necessarily want to enshrine. But I think that we have this giant apparatus of regulatory procedures and courts and other sorts of things for trying to resolve definitional issues on many of these issues. And I think the notion that we can, that there's some silver bullet that we can do this off in a corner with, you know, 50 people in a room with CS degrees or philosophy degrees is somewhat utopian. So I think in addition to provenance, in addition to working with these communities, I think we're going to need contextualization mechanisms that let us deal with some of these inconsistencies. And I think that if we go down this route and we manage to convince these communities that we are engaged not in redefining what they're doing, but in formalizing what they're doing, I think that it will be a much easier sell, and then we may be able to come along and sort of say, well, it would be nice if you could clean up some of these things, and they may or may not be amenable to it. But just consider the debate going on in this country as to what a person is over abortion legislation. That's not something that we're going to decide in this room. Anyway.
So we're at the end of our time, and before we all enroll in law school, let's have lunch.